The first matter on our calendar this morning is State versus Hoskins. It looks like council are here and ready to proceed. Before we get started, each of you will have 15 minutes for your principal argument. Appellant will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. If the appellant wishes to use that time, make sure you state your name and the party you represent before you begin your comments so that we've got that for the recording. The podium is adjustable if you want to. There's a little toggle switch beneath it somewhere. If it's comfortable, that's fine too. Appellant's counsel, whenever you're ready, you may proceed.
Thank you and good morning, Your Honors. May it please this court, counsel. My name is Paul Shoemaker. I'm here on behalf of the appellant, Casey Hoskins. I would like to reserve the 5 minute rebuttal time. The legal issues presented in this sentencing appeal were stated as three issues. The last of those, the third, that is the challenge to the revocation of good time credit for the original first year of incarceration is generally rendered moot at this time. Mr. Hoskins has remained in the county jail during the entire duration of that year. So we withdraw that motion or that issue before
so
the court.
So we don't need to address issue number three?
Correct, Your Honor. The other two issues do remain in play, and I have couched them as the following. Did the state meet its burden of proof by clear and convincing evidence that the appellant, Mr. Hoskins, violated a condition of probation that was alleged the day prior to the court's hearing? The procedural history on this is that Mr. Hoskins pled guilty to a plea agreement. He was sentenced to 1 year in jail. He had some 23 conditions imposed on him and a 10-year term of probation. He reported that same day, January 15, he served in a community work release program for 3 months without any allegations that he had violated the law. But on the Saturday of April 13, he ran in the field of recreational runners in a hot chocolate run in Minneapolis. The county discovered his participation in that. The deputies took the position that he was not where he was supposed to be. He was disciplined and he served 17 days in segregation isolation from April 16th until May 2nd. He remained in custody up until the time of the hearing. The facts also presented were that the probation officer had an intake meeting with Mr. Hoskins on March 27, wherein they went over the conditions of his probation.
This is shortly after the sentencing.
Yes, Your Honor. Okay. January 15, he reported, and the facts before the district court, sentencing court, were that they met on an intake meeting on March 27. And at that meeting, the probation agent indicated to Mr. Hoskins that she wanted him to complete a chemical use assessment.
Which was a condition of the probation?
Yes. The court had required him to have an assessment made and to follow recommendations. There was no precise date. There was no other condition made on it by the sentencing court. It was largely delegated to the probation office. The probation office officer there reported in her report that Mr. Hoskins asked about all options and said that no one in the jail really liked him and that he would like to explore other options for other providers. And there was no other testimony offered nor evidence of any other further communications between the probation officer and Mr. Hoskins about that particular assessment.
Where did the ASAP language come from? Was it in that conversation?
That's the language that Ms. Englund testified she used in when she set the expectation of how soon it should be done.
So ASAP. On March 27th, she said as soon as possible.
Well, that's what her testimony was.
Is that an issue on appeal for us, whether that's a fact, an error?
No.
Okay.
No, that was reported in the addendum report that was filed at 3 in the afternoon on the 5th of June. So the addendum alleged this new element of he hasn't complied with an assessment. On the 15th of May, we'd appeared before the district court to have sort of a preliminary hearing. It was set on that date for the review hearing that the defendant had made under the provisions of Chapter 631, asking for the court to review the determination made by the jail to remove him from the community work release program. So we came on before the court on the 15th, and at that same time, we did the initial appearance or the first appearance on the probation revocation, and that was the subject of the May 9 filing, May 7, 2019 report, which largely covered the same exact conduct that he'd been disciplined in jail for. That is, running the race, not where he was supposed to be, violated the terms and conditions of the jail's work release program.
That was the first probation violation notice.
That was, right, that was the instance that we filed on May 6, our review, May 9, the state says you should go to prison for 4 years because you ran a recreational road race. The court directed at the May 15 appearance the parties to exchange discovery, do the, you know, the, all of the back and forth exchange of information related to this violation report that was filed by the probation department, Department of Corrections. On Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday of the week in the lead up to the Thursday hearing on June 6, there were some 20 or 21, 22, 23 victim impact statements that were also submitted. The district court indicated as after it recessed from hearing testimony that it had read through those reports. Those reports were submitted by a parent, family, and friends of the victim, and almost in without exception, they asked for the court to do justice this time because it hadn't been done the first time in the plea agreement. Not one of them accurately recited the facts that the probation violation. They all made erroneous reports or allegations that the defendant had somehow broken the law or had violated the conditions of his probation by drinking alcohol. He'd been tested twice. Once on the intake, he was negative. Another anonymous tip came in during his participation in the work release program.
Was that the email one about using cocaine?
Yes, I believe so, Your Honor. And so he was tested for that, and it was negative. The only evidence presented at the hearing was really largely related to the conduct that Mr. Hoskins had engaged in running in this recreational field of runners, and he had, in a communication with his fiance, talked about stopping in at a jewelry store, making a payment on a ring, an engagement ring. At the hearing, there was also confirmation or the establishment of that the defendant and his fiance had had sexual relations when he was out on work release. It wasn't really expounded.
Well, that actually was never identified as a probation violation, was it?
No. It wasn't.
It may be troubling, but that wasn't really the subject of the hearing.
Well, it clearly wasn't in the reports that were filed by the probation office. The hearing largely expanded to include this 11th hour allegation that he hadn't performed his chemical dependency assessment. He'd had one during his release pending the final plea arrangements.
Of course, he also had a probation, he had a release violation of having an over 0.08 alcohol concentration while on release, which included conditions that he wasn't supposed to be drinking alcohol.
Yes, I think that's of the record as well, Your Honor. It's not subsequent to the time that he reported to the jail.
Right, but my point is whatever assessments were done pre-plea, he had already messed up that situation by drinking when he wasn't supposed to.
Well, he may have violated the court's order. I don't know what the recommendations were in that Rule 25 assessment. I don't know if they spotted a
I don't think they're in the record, are they?
Yeah. Well, I don't know that I've looked at it. The defendant was represented by another attorney at the time he entered the plea.
Mr. Schumacher, with respect to the requirement to have a CD assessment, do you accept the premise that if he didn't do what the probation officer said he should do, that would be a violation, or are you arguing that the violation, the timing of the requirement must be imposed by the district court at the time of sentencing?
Well, I think I would just stress the idea that if this is going to be a condition of probation and it's going to be a violation, which the consequence of which can lead to imprisonment, the defendant has a right to be made aware of what the violation is so that he can adequately explain himself. We had no opportunity to do that.
Is that, so when you say that, just to pin that down a little bit, is that from whom does he have a right to know that? So let's assume for a moment the probation officer on May 27th said, get it done by June 1. And it was not done by June 1.
So if that were the case, which it's not, because there's absolutely no testimony or facts that develop about a follow-up.
Right, it's ASAP.
ASAP.
Right.
And from April 16, he's locked up, and he's not going anywhere. And part of that, he's on a scram bracelet.
Right, I'm just trying to understand legally who has to set the date.
I submit that it's not maybe entirely clear on our case law. However, it looks to me as if it's a condition that can involve incarceration, it has to be something the judge imposed, because incarceration is not available to the probation department.
I think the warrant of commitment says that the conditions are to get a CD evaluation, follow recommendations, and I think there's a separate one to follow instructions of probation. Can probation issue instructions that then are including the date of getting an evaluation if it's not done by the court? Are you saying the court, only the court, can set a deadline?
I would say that in the instance of can the court delegate to probation the administrative tasks, it's clear under our case law that the district court does not have to set out all of the precise guidelines for the probation requirements. Those can be delegated, for instance, the treatment and the recommendations made by the treatment provider, those can be delegated, and our case law suggests and affirms that as a delegation. What's not clear is that in a technical violation, that these were both lawful activities. These did not involve illegal conduct that was alleged by formal complaint, summons, warrant, petition. These were items that fall directly under that statute that deals with the probation department and the probationer working through the violations in a sanctions conference. After which, if it's apparent that there's still no compliance, then the probation department has the right to seek a consequence from the court. But fundamentally, someone who appears with their probation officer at the first meeting and only meeting of record, and the person says, well, I'd like to get done quickly or ASAP, and then does not follow up with that person, I don't think the defendant in this instance gets fair notice of the likelihood of a consequence. And at the last minute, he cannot call a provider and say, well, I just took care of that yesterday, or I just took care of that the day before.
Well, did he ask for more time when the May 7th addendum was filed?
Your Honor, because I didn't anticipate that was even an issue, I didn't inquire of my client. There are facts that I have since learned, which I think color this considerably, but they're not of the record in the district court. And they do express an intention by Mr. Hoskins to be responsive to any testing that he may be required to do.
Was there any evidence that he had taken steps to find the assessment professional or to set it up?
Not of the record, Your Honor. The facts that do color this that will be provided to the district court on a motion for stay of the execution of the additional year indicate that Mr. Hoskins had asked about other providers and was waiting for a response of a list of those providers so that he could make contact to those people.
And he had asked whom?
He'd asked Cassandra Engelin, his probation agent. But
that's the same person. Isn't that the same person that submitted the addendum?
Yes, Your Honor. That is his was his probation agent at the time. It's fundamental to me that in our Rule 27 procedures require that a person who's facing a revocation proceeding, whether that's an intermediate sanction or the revocation of probation and a commitment to the state, should have some notice, appropriate notice. And while there is perhaps a degree of inattention by myself to that, frankly, I found it peculiar that at the last day before, when I'm looking at 23 victim impact statements, the state slides this over where there's no recommendation even made in the addendum. It says, we'll reserve that for the time of disposition. And I'm thinking, well, what is this doing here? There's no precise date. There's no allegation that he made a comment that he was going to you know, screw you, or some other remark that said he wasn't going to do this. In fact, his own comment at the hearing was, if I'd have known this was a problem, I'd have taken care of it. So he truly, I think, was taken by surprise, as was I. That day before, I was working on a trial memo that I sent to the court and outlining all of the issues that I thought, the legal issues that were to be addressed with the lawful conduct of the running in the recreational race. The outcome of this is what we believe to be just an abuse of discretion by the imposition of an additional year for this last violation, this failure to get a chemical use assessment, which is the preliminary step to determine whether or not you should do something further. I'm out of time, Your Honor.
I'm going to take the liberty, and maybe my colleagues have questions too. I have one sort of question as to the state of the record. The only transcript I see in the record is a transcript of the violation hearing it was filed in August. The hearing that we're talking about, the probation violation.
Yes, Your Honor, the June 6th. But
I don't have a copy. I don't see one in the file of the sentencing transcript. Do we have that?
Yes, you do, Your Honor. It's at addendum page 10. It starts there. It's the partial transcript of the appearance of the parties, and it is the record of the sentencing by Judge Kane made on January 15th of 2019.
Okay.
And it really covers the manners that the court stated on the record to Mr. Hoskins. And in regard to this, she said, "You on page 15, you must do a chemical dependency assessment and follow recommendations. I'm also going to order a domestic abuse evaluation as well."
Okay, I did see that page. That's the one where she says, "I believe you are a risk to public safety if you are using, so it's critical that you get whatever help that you need, you must do a chemical dependency evaluation."
Yes, Your Honor.
All right. Did you have a question, too?
I did, and I apologize, Mr. Schumacher, but at the beginning of your argument, you said something was moot, and I missed it.
Yes, it's
could
it's
you
the
please
third
repeat
issue.
That?
He's remained incarceration in the county jail, and so any issue that relates to whether the court abused its discretion in taking away his good time credit, the court really expanded the 8 months to a year for the recreational running. At least that's what it looks like on the record. But he served out that entire year now, and there's a motion to be heard next Tuesday on the issue of whether he should be released pending the disposition of this court.
Well, you're also challenging the imposition of an additional year of...
I am, but that by the court's own explanation was based on the violation of failing to get a chemical use assessment.
Right, so that second year.
Yes, that second year,
is still an issue.
It's the equivalent of a 3-year incarceration term. When
right.
You consider the loss of good time.
But if you were to be unsuccessful on that issue, wouldn't you still be interested in preserving his right to good time credits for the remainder of the 2-year period?
Well, yes, Your Honor. On the second year that runs consecutive to the first without good time. Yes, we're certainly interested in the court.
Okay, so I apologize. So I'm still not understanding what's moot.
Simply the removal of good time for the first year of incarceration.
Oh, from previous, looking backwards.
Looking
retrospectively.
Backwards.
But didn't the district court, okay, I understand. But is there also an issue about good time prospectively?
Yes, there is, Your Honor.
So maybe
again, I
maybe
think
half of that last issue is moot, but they're partially moot, but still partially.
Yes, perhaps the way you're looking at it. I think it's an abuse of discretion to say I'm going to take away anything and everything going forward. They've been tripling the term of incarceration you're actually going to serve, when the only basis for that would be the additional year is for something that he didn't receive any notice on.
You're continuing to argue that the prospective was error.
Yes, I am, Your Honor.
I think you know what I meant to say.
Yes,
it was an incomplete sentence. But, okay,
thank you.
Thank you.
Yep. All right. You will have 5 minutes on rebuttal if you wish to use that time.
Good morning, and may it please the court, counsel. My name is Angela Erickson, and I represent Respondent, the State of Minnesota. Each of the issues that appellant raised in his brief are reviewed under an abuse of discretion standard, meaning that the findings and sentence must not be arbitrary and capricious. That doesn't necessarily mean that this court must agree with those findings or decision, or that they may be ones that you all yourselves would have made. However, they must not be overturned unless they have no reasonable basis. On the issue of the probation violation, the state presented clear and convincing evidence that condition number 4 of appellant's sentencing order on January 15th of 2019 was that he complete a chemical use assessment. And the court impressed upon him at his sentencing hearing that that was a very important condition of his probation that needed to...
You're looking at the same language that I just went over with Mr. Shoemaker?
That's correct, Your Honor.
The key question is when, right?
Correct. And I would, the state would argue that when Ms. Englund met with Mr. Hoskins on March 27th of 2019 and instructed him that he needed to complete that as soon as possible and while in custody, that not having that completed months later on June 6th of 2019 did not complete her conditions for him that he completed as soon as possible.
So I don't think this was brief, but I seem to have a recollection that you said her conditions, the probation officer's conditions. Isn't there a requirement that any conditions of a violation must be imposed by the court?
Your Honor, I would argue that the court did order that they follow the instructions of probation. It is not, it's very common for probation agents to take over these administrative tasks as to when the conditions are completed. It is very uncommon for the district court to put deadlines on each of the assessments, et cetera, to be completed. I think there's a strong public policy basis in that, given that the probation agents are working closely with the probationers and are in the best position to determine when those should be completed based on other conditions that they may need to complete of their probation, scheduling, et cetera. For instance, if the district court ordered that Mr. Hoskins complete it by May 1st and he was unable to do so, the probation agent would be under an obligation to file a violation because it would be a violation of the court's order, despite the fact that there may be a valid reasoning that he did not complete that.
I'm a little puzzled as to why that wasn't part. If time was of the essence in getting that done, and I understand that there might have been good reason to think that time should have been of the essence in getting that done, why wasn't that put in as a term of the plea agreement or clarified at the time of sentencing? My understanding is this was a presumptive commit, wasn't it?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Someone had died.
Correct.
Why didn't the state, when it was negotiating the deal, or clarifying at the sentencing hearing itself, some sort of a timing for that?
Your Honor, I understand the court's concern, and I would echo that. I would do things differently going forward. However, I would say that it is very common in Carver County that a deadline is not put in as a condition of probation.
I was on the district court, and I understand that in a typical case, but boy, this does not look like a typical case.
And we do work very closely with our Department of Corrections agents, and they are on the probationers in these types of sentences very closely. We do have a lot of trust in them to monitor those and make sure those are completed in a timely manner. Your Honor, I would also note, as far as notice to the appellant, that as the court noted in the transcript, there was a chambers conference about a month prior to this hearing in which the district court noted that it was a violation that he had not completed the chemical use assessment to...
Is that in the record?
It is, Your Honor. It is on page 126.
And what is the document entitled? I'm not going to try and find it right this minute.
126
the,
of what?
Of the probation violation transcript. The transcript of the June 6th hearing.
Of the transcript itself, okay.
That's correct, Your Honor.
But is there a separate transcript or recording of what happened in the chambers conference?
No, Your Honor.
Okay.
At that time, appellant's counsel was aware of that, and appellant made no attempt at that time between the May bench conference and the June 6th probation violation hearing to complete the chemical use assessment. I would also note that the district court noted that appellant had the opportunity to ask for a continuance of that June 6th hearing after the violation was completed if he had wished to have an opportunity to complete the chemical use assessment within that time and failed to do so.
What is, counsel, what is the date of the chambers conference that was described in the hearing?
Your Honor, it was in May, shortly after appellant filed the request for review of the revocation of work release and good time. I'm not sure that the date is in the record. It would be in the register of actions, however. It was the date of the hearing.
Am I correct that the district court did not issue a written order, but she made findings from the bench about the at the conclusion of the revocation hearing?
Or that's correct, Your Honor.
And did the judge make any findings in terms of, with respect, am I correct that there were sort of some differences in the testimony between the defendant and the probation officer about who said what, or were those facts undisputed?
The facts were generally undisputed. I believe they were generally undisputed, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you.
I don't know if you have a particular question about something in particular.
Not more particular. I'm wondering did the defendant deny what the probation officer testified to about, you know, her telling him you have to do this as soon as possible?
No, Your Honor.
So he agreed that she said that, but he had a different understanding of what that meant, I guess.
Correct. That would be my understanding, Your Honor. There was no, it was not an issue in contention as to whether Ms. Englund directed him to complete that as soon as possible and while in custody.
Okay.
Your Honor, I also noted that appellant's counsel noted that Mr. Hoskins, the appellant, was waiting for a list of assessors. However, Ms. Englund never testified to that, and I could not find that in any record from appellant. So I do not believe that that is in the record, Your Honor.
Did Hoskins testify to that?
I can't find that, Your Honor. I don't believe that that's accurate.
Can I ask, counsel, when you refer to in custody, what was the earliest that the custody would have ended? Was that at that time? Was that September or?
September, Your Honor.
Okay.
That's correct. Ms. Englund's testimony was that she, in the conversation where she directed Mr. Hoskins to complete that as soon as possible, she provided him information about an assessor within the jail who could complete that while he was in custody. And also provided him an opportunity to obtain that chemical use assessment in the community while he was on work release. I would also note that the court and Ms. Englund indicated to Mr. Hoskins that social services was available to come to the jail to complete a chemical use assessment as well.
So what does that mean? I mean, I think his argument is I didn't want to do it at the jail, I wanted to do it in a community wasn't mean to be provided the opportunity to do it, that she provided him the opportunity to do it on work release. What specifically, what did she do?
She instructed Mr. Hoskins that he could contact an assessor of his choosing and have that assessment completed while he was out in the community on work release.
She told him that in the March meeting?
Correct.
Okay.
And that also is contained, I think, in the addendum to the violation report, that she said he could get an assessment done while on work release.
That's correct, Your Honor. That was provided in her testimony as well, I believe, on page 60 through 63 of the probation violation transcript. Your Honors, I also... I don't know where the information came from that Mr. Hoskins was unwilling to obtain the assessment from a provider in the jail. I don't have any information that he provided that information to Ms. Englund. However, if he did, that would be alleviated by her providing him the opportunity to do that outside in the community. Mr. Hoskins certainly had access to telephone, both while he was in custody and while he was out on work release. He was infrequent. Ms. Englund also provided him the opportunity to have his fiance set up that assessment as well, as she was his transportation means at that time. Your Honor, the state's position is that Mr. Hoskins had immense opportunity to obtain that assessment in the community if he wished to do so. He had opportunities to run a race, spend time with his fiance, doing normal life activities, going to the jewelry store, et cetera. He certainly could have used that. He wasn't simply working the whole time while he was out on work release. He certainly could have used that opportunity to get the chemical use assessment done and failed to do so.
So the discussion, excuse me, I'm sorry. So the discussion that, was, or the information, whatever communication, I guess, with him about needing to get it done in the timeline occurs in the March 27th meeting. There's discussion of it in the chamber, the May, some date in May. And is that, is there, are there any other communications that are of record between, well, related to that, I guess? Are those the two things that we would look at, the only two things?
The three things that the court would look at were the May 27th meeting with the appellant's probation agent, the
March 27th.
March 27th,
okay.
I apologize. Mm-hmm. The May bench conference with the court, where it was indicated to appellant's counsel, and also the violation that was filed prior to the violation hearing in which he was on notice that that would be a violation that the state would be proceeding on at the hearing that
and
was
that
scheduled for June 6th.
Excuse me, and then what date was that filed before the June 6th hearing then?
I believe it was filed on June 4th.
June 4th, so 2 days before the hearing.
Correct, Your Honor.
Thanks.
And the district court did indicate to appellant's counsel that if it wished a continuance, that was available to him.
And apparently they didn't ask for that.
That's correct. Your Honor, with regards to the good time provision, Your Honor, the district court is not limited to the 1 year incarceration in local jail time on a probation violation. It's clear that the court's intention was for him to sit for 365 actual days as a consequence for his probation violation. Whether it used the statement of no good time or whether it used it would have imposed a longer sentence and then just taken good time off of that is really irrelevant in the view of the state. The intention was that he serve 365 days incarceration, and that was an option available to the court as an intermediate sanction for the probation violation. Certainly, if Mr. Hoskins' sentence is revoked and he is committed to the Commissioner of Corrections, he would still be entitled to the one-third good time off of that sentence.
Well, the way the way the judge's order reads to me, or comments from the bench at least read to me, is he doesn't get the good time, so that if he served the 365, he wouldn't get any credit for good time, and he later violated, he would not be able to go back and get that good time.
Your Honor, I don't think that that's within the court's discretion to remove good time from a commitment to the Commissioner of Corrections.
I didn't ask the question. Perhaps that was my problem. Let me try again. She says he should do 365 days and he should get no good time. If he does that time and then is later committed to the Commissioner of Corrections, he ends up serving 4 months more than he would have had the judge not done that. Total, correct?
I don't believe that's accurate, Your Honor. I believe he would get actual credit for both 365-day sentences that he served off of his commitment to the Commissioner of Corrections, so then he would be released on supervised release.
By what mechanism would DOC go back and give him good time for time that was served in the custody of the Carver County Sheriff?
When a sentence is executed, the court directs what credit should be given in actual days. And so that both of those 365-day sentences would be granted as credit for both for the actual amount of time Mr. Hoskins served. So assuming he got good time, and it was 200 whatever days, my math is terrible, that he actually served and his sentence was executed, the court would commit him to the Commissioner of Corrections with credit for 200 and X amount of days. This way, she would be committing him to the Commissioner of Corrections for 700 some days, with credit for 700 some days. So he would still be receiving that good time off of the executed prison sentence with the one-third on supervised release.
Am I correct in understanding that the district judge also ordered that if he earns good time in the future, or that he can't earn good time in the future so long as he is in jail. Is that what the judge ordered?
I believe her order was that he served 365 actual days in the jail and then confirmed no good time so that the jail would understand that he not receive one-third off of that sentence and that it should be 365 actual days.
What about during the second year of jail time?
Correct.
Same.
365-day actual, as a sanction for the probation violation, she imposed 365 actual days incarceration in the local jail.
Okay, without any opportunity for good time.
Correct.
But doesn't 643.29 say that any person shall be entitled to good time? It doesn't say if the judge thinks it's a good idea, they get good time. It says they shall.
I agree, Your Honor. It does. I think the court's intention was that he served 365 actual days. She could have imposed a longer period of time as a consequence for that probation violation.
Could she have? Local jail time is usually limited to 1 year.
That is accurate. However, I believe under the Johnson case, Your Honor, it indicates that for a probation violation, the court is not limited to that 365 days.
Can you give me the cite on that?
Yes, Your Honor.
Is it in your materials?
It is in the brief, Your Honor.
Okay, I can look at it.
Can I ask one follow-up, just so that I understand? So he was to be on probation for 1 year. As a result of the, and there would have been good time had he earned it, right, to
Correct.
Let him out earlier in September. As a result of the decision here, he will instead serve two 365-day terms of
that
in
is
jail.
That
is that right?
Accurate, yes.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Schumacher, if you have any additional comments, you do have 5 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honors. A couple of points that were raised in the argument by the state. First is that the defendant did not testify at the June 6th hearing. We did not call Mr. Hoskins. There was no point. He acknowledged that he had run the race. He had served his 17 days in segregation. There was really no reason for me to put him on the stand. And I tried to honor that rule that most lawyers are taught very early on, never ask the question that you don't know the answer to. So I saw no upside to putting him on the stand to get into the conversations with his probation agent. It's pretty clear that other than the March 27 instance where he was informed and the June 6 date when he shows up and starts to hear the testimony about his failure to get a chemical use assessment, that he himself was not made aware that this could be a violation of his probation if he did not get it done within a certain period of time. Now,
he got the June 4th notice.
June 5th at 3:03 in the afternoon.
Okay.
One day, less than one day prior to this hearing.
Okay, I just, when you said he didn't know until he showed up, but I just wanted to make sure that you're not saying
he
didn't get the notice.
Because I didn't get an opportunity to even talk with him in the Carver County Jail on the 5th of June. I was filing my briefs, and I was looking at 23 victim impact statements. So we arrived the next morning, and I have a little opportunity, but he's in custody, so we have a little colloquy between the two of us, and I say there's some new allegation here. And I get whispers here and whispers there, and the day progresses, and I frankly discarded this because there's no recommendation even made by the agent, and there's no other follow-up that would show that either intentionally or unintentionally he had any intent to not abide the court's order that said you should get your assessment. Now, there was
but the evidence on this is kind of one-sided. I mean, we don't.
Sure,
I mean, what you're telling us about what he knew or didn't know is not in the record, right?
Well, what he did know. And what was done is on April or May 15 was the initial appearance before the court on the probation revocation. The proceedings started that day. They were amended later to add new information, new adjustments is what it's referred to add information that's developed since. Well, there really isn't any information developed since May 9. There was information developed before May 9. That is, he was told in March 27 that he should get an assessment done ASAP. But there's nothing that comes into the record that talks about communications or unwillingness by the defendant to commit to the assessment, to get it done. In the aftermath, he was told by the court, I want this done within, set an appointment within a week, and he did, and get it completed thereafter. Many of these assessments, as the court may be aware, these assessments are done in a manner that, based on availability, and they may or may not be completely dispositive on the issue. The district court made reference that it was unfortunate that the state hadn't amended to add the domestic violence assessment, because had that been before the court, court would have addressed that too. Well, I think that that in some ways reflects the a problematic emotion by the court, that the court was somehow swayed that, that he was disregarding this. Let's remember that if we were to take March 27 to April 16, we have a full 20 days, some of which he was incarcerated. We had 20 days in which he could have gone into the community and found the assessor and lined that up. But he wasn't told that if he doesn't do it like this, you're going to go to jail. There's 71 days between the day that he meets with the probation officer and the hearing. And in the middle of the 71 days, there's no evidence that Mr. Hoskins was intending to say, I'm just disregarding that.
How can 71 days be ASAP, though? I mean, that doesn't, well, like, you know, what evidence do you need of disregard besides the fact that it just simply wasn't done?
Well, I don't, in my schedule,